bit and then come back. So we'll go to number 25 with our special guest from Minnesota, who, John, are you going to introduce him?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I can certainly do that.
Great.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, Secretary Hepler. In the past few months, we've been talking a lot about approaches to aquatic invasive species management in South Dakota. One of the big parts of our overall management program is watercraft inspections and decontaminations. And we've visited about the Western model for that, how it's handled in states to the west of us. And it's my pleasure today to introduce the watercraft inspection coordinator with the state of Minnesota, Mr. Adam Dahl. Adam has been with the invasive species program in Minnesota since 2009, and he received his master's degree in 2015 from the University of Minnesota. The topic of that thesis is very much related to some of our discussions the last few months, and that it was about the occurrence and survival of zebra mussel belagers in residual water transported by recreational watercraft. And Adam has been the coordinator for the inspection program since 2015. And this afternoon he has a presentation for us that's an overview of the Minnesota Watercraft Inspection Program. Adam?
Thank you, John. Happy to be here. Greetings to Mr. Chair and all the commissioners. My presentation, we'll get into it. I'll try to go through it pretty quickly, and hopefully there's a little bit of a back and forth. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have about Minnesota's program here. So, John, you can just go ahead and skip forward to the next slide, and we'll hop into it. I don't have any good maps for you. It's a tough act to follow on what I just sat in with. Sorry, mine is pretty text-heavy. So what I'd like to do is just sort of paint an overview of the history of the program in Minnesota, and the slides are a little bit information heavy, more so than I would normally do, but I thought it might be an interesting reference point to go back to. As far as the timeline for the DNR invasive species program as a whole, there's a couple of highlighted ones on here on the list. The program started in 1987, and it was all about purple loosestrife and rearing beetles and managing the wetland plant. In 1992 is when the watercraft inspection program was created, so it's quite old. We were actually legislatively required to complete 10,000 watercraft inspection hours each year, and that was the start of the program. It was done by the Conservation Corps of Minnesota and conservation officers as well, and it was a totally voluntary program. But that was the first formation of it. So we've been around for quite a while. Another one to point out on here is the last piece in 1994, talking about funding for our program. The invasive species program is funded largely through watercraft registration surcharges. It was raised to $5 in 1994, and that's where it remained for quite a while. Next slide. In the 2000s, it was pretty much the status quo as far as where we were. There wasn't a lot happening. The 2010s was really where our program started to grow as a whole. I started in the program in 2009 as an intern, actually, and there was a small group of people working in the invasive species program, and the program today as a whole is quite a bit larger than it was in 2009. The main pieces as far as the inspection program goes occurred in 2011, and that's when the legislature expanded the authority for our inspection program, and it actually gave inspectors legal authority to require inspections. So from 92 until 2011, all the inspections that occurred here were voluntary. You could tell somebody no to move on and move to the next boat. That all changed in 2011. We also established a Lake Service Provider Program, which was another piece. Essentially, the Lake Service Providers are anybody that installs or moves or rents equipment, so marinas and dock installers, everything like that. They pay for a permit and take some training to try and address some of the spread issues. The big one here to keep an eye on is the 2014 edition of AIS Prevention Aid. That's a statute I'll get into in a little bit here, but that's what largely funds most of the inspection programs in Minnesota. It's $10 million a year that goes directly from the Department of Revenue here to county programs. We provide support and guidance, but we don't oversee what happens with that money or anything like that. And then the most recent change was just last year with the AIS watercraft registration surcharge increasing from $5 to $10.50. And that was much needed. It was a long time coming. I know it had been brought up and shot down multiple times. So it was good to see that finally happen last year. Next slide. From a invasive species timeline, John asked to spend a little bit of time on the movement of species throughout Minnesota. The zebra mussel is the main one that I know we're talking about today, and that was found in 1989, originally in Lake Superior, having colonized through the Great Lakes area and much of the Mississippi River in Minnesota. Down between the Wisconsin-Minnesota corridor was colonized shortly thereafter in the early 90s. The next really big jump was 2000, and that was when mussels were first found in inland lakes in Minnesota with Lake Sumbro. Just to point out another one, the star stonewort is a relatively new infestation that we have in a limited number of lakes. We're still doing large-scale searches to try and find where that is, but that's the most recent species. It's an aquatic macroalgae that is problematic here. We do, I just put our source on there, we do list all of our infested waters with the date that we found it, the date it was infested, designated infested on our website, and it'll also list connected bodies of water. That's a big one for zebra mussels, since we do have such interconnected waterways. Oftentimes new infestations happen through the flow of water, or we designate lakes to be infested as a precautionary measure, given the fact that they're connected by rivers or channels or things of that nature. Next slide. So from a funding perspective, Minnesota's program is quite large from a funding aspect. The program is funded largely through that invasive species surcharge. I do want to point out this is from our annual report last year, so the increase to $10.50 hasn't come in yet. We're working on our annual report right now, so I expect that $3.2 million to be higher for the report this year. I don't deal a whole lot with the overall budget. The dark blue square is inspections and enforcement combined. We do spend a considerable amount of money with conservation officer support to help with invasive species violations, so they're lumped into there. For a reference, you could estimate around $2 million annually goes to the Minnesota DNR's Watercraft Inspection Program. Next slide. This is a little bit more about that AIS prevention aid. That pie chart obviously is very messy and noisy, but that just shows you the breakdown of the money that's allocated to the different counties in Minnesota. That money, again, is $10 million annually. And that's allocated out to the counties, not on a perfect metric. It was they're trying to use the best information they can, but the money is given out based on the number of public water accesses that are available from county to county, and then there's also a metric on the number of spaces there. So again, they're trying to allocate money to places with lots of public water accesses lots of parking. It doesn't work all that well for places like Lake of the Woods County is a good outlier that we have here up on Lake of the Woods. Most, even though that's a very highly used destination lake in Minnesota on the border there, the vast majority of the accesses on the lake are resorts and private accesses. So that doesn't get counted in this. And so Lake of the Woods County doesn't get as much money as some of the others do. Other places might not have large parking, and the lakes are very busy, but there's just not parking there. I can think of Minneapolis lakes here. We have some pretty busy lakes in the metro, and there's just not lands or real estate open for parking. So they get hindered a little bit too. There are a couple of counties that don't get any dollars in the southwest portion of the state. The largest is 711, and this is from 2018. It fluctuates a little bit each year, but on average, the counties are getting about $100,000 a year. And like I said earlier, from a funding metric, this program right here, this money is largely responsible for the large number of inspections that we do in Minnesota. Next slide. Okay, so that's a very quick overview of the program as a whole. The watercraft inspection program that I coordinate has a goal to prevent the spread of invasive species within Minnesota through boater education, watercraft inspection, and watercraft decontaminations at public water accesses. The main pieces of our inspection program that I think work really well is the fact that we have so many partnerships throughout Minnesota that end up doing the inspections. The Minnesota DNR does have an inspection program. We have four supervisors throughout the state, one for each of our four regions, and then they hire seasonal staff that operate our decontamination units, and then we also have internships for inspectors out there. But we make up about 92 inspectors of sometimes upwards of 1,000 inspectors statewide. So we're the largest program, the largest single program, but there are many, many programs out there. What we do for consistency is we enter into delegation agreements with any local government unit or tribal entity that wants to do inspections. So all of our authority is in our state statute. We can delegate that out to very specifically, and it is called out in statute, local government units or tribal entities. As an example, we can't delegate legally our authority to lake associations, who often would like to run their own programs, but we don't have a legal framework to do that. And I think the idea behind that, I wasn't involved at these levels of discussion, obviously, but it's a keeping it within local government programs hopefully helps with consistency and having trained professionals out there and sort of a neutral party as well. You're trying to treat everybody fairly across the landscape. And not saying that lake associations won't do that, but there's a little bit of a conflict of interest there that hopefully local government units don't have. Within our programs, then all staff, anybody that's going to be an inspector has to attend an annual training, and then they're required to follow Minnesota protocols and procedures. And that's one, even from talking to states out west that I work with, that's pretty unique to Minnesota, and it works pretty well. The idea being that when you enter into a delegation agreement with us, whether you are a DNR inspector or a county inspector or a park inspector, we're all following the same set of protocols and procedures. We've all had the same training. So there's some consistency there, whether you're in the northwest part of the state or the southeast part of the state. Next slide. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here, but part of the reporting process for all of these programs is a relatively easy document to fill out that's just an end of season report where we ask how big your program was, how many accesses you went to. Hopefully they provide us with our data. It's not required to complete that portion, but it gives us a good understanding of the breakdown of the different programs within Minnesota. When I talk to states out east, or you know, even some of the western states about getting programs, Minnesota, I can say, is number one or number two. We're slightly behind Colorado this year in overall inspections, but we did 600,000 plus inspections this year, and we trained about 900 people, give or take. And so if you don't have a program at all, those are massive numbers, right? And it seems very daunting to get to that level. But if you take a look at the demographics of the different programs here, this is the results of our 2019 season. We had 60 local units of government enter into delegation agreements and conduct inspections and have inspection programs. Most of those are relatively small, almost 50%, you can see on that left pie chart, had under 10 staff. So we're talking about small numbers of staff here. Likewise, some of these programs are close to 50%, again, aren't doing thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of inspections. They're between 1,000 and 5,000 inspections. And then on the right-hand side, again, roughly a third or maybe a little bit more are really only inspecting from 1 to 5 accesses. So again, there's 60 programs. Collectively, 922 people were trained that did almost 250,000 hours. However, most of those programs are quite small. And so again, that's that framework that we set up with delegation agreements and funding going directly to these groups. It allows me as a coordinator to work with all of them, provide guidance and consistent training, and as long as it's working correctly, the inspectors, whether they're a county inspector or one of ours, it's the same level of service and thoroughness in the field. Next slide. As far as the efforts go, the money was in 2014, and that's really seen in the 2015 results there. The green bar on the left is the total number of inspectors. Prior to 2015, when that money was available to all the groups, there were some programs, some of the most well-funded programs. Three Rivers Park District comes to mind. They're a very, very large park district in the metro area here that had inspectors, had funding to pay for their own inspectors. But come 2015 was when we really expanded the program as a whole. And again, that's largely due to that new funding that went directly to these groups. We've steadily increased on the numbers of inspections. 2019 was the first time we crossed the 500,000 mark. And this year, you can see we had a dip on the total number of inspectors that we hired. Or the state hired as a whole, we still surpassed the goal. We are maybe at around 610,000 right now. We're not going to get much higher than that. We have a couple of programs that inspect until the end of November, but most programs are shut down now. And that drop in staff is very much due to COVID and the difficulties in getting trainings set up, getting people hired, everything like that. As far as the by the numbers piece, most of the boats that people interact with are following state laws. So 97%, and again, this is 2019 statistics. I haven't done 2020 yet, but it's going to be very similar. 97% of watercraft inspected, we didn't find anything yet. So that's always very good to see, and that's that boat's coming into lake. Likewise, we do have a drain plug law. I skimmed over that in the timeline, but you are supposed to transport your watercraft with the plugs out and your watercraft drain, and we do see very high rates of compliance with that now. It has steadily increased slowly over the time period. So if I charted that out back in 2015, the rates would have been lower for compliance there, and I think we're around 97%. This year with compliance. And then again, the notable piece here about zebra mussels and zebra mussels moving around. We do continually find zebra mussels during inspections. we found zebra mussels 191 times last year. And something worth noting there is 25 of those 191 are at lakes not known to be infested. So again, the vast majority of the zebra mussels we find are boats coming back to the same lake. Usually that happens in springtime with boats that are leaving or that are going back to their home lake, like Minnetonka is heavily infested and they didn't clean them off thoroughly. Alive or dead, doesn't matter according to state law here, so they'll always get counted there and enforcement may or may not follow up with them. But again, 25 were inspected, or 25 were stopped prior to entering uninfested lakes. Okay, next question. As far as the authorities go that Minnesota has, I want to stay real high level for you. But again, the inspection authority was passed by the legislature in 2011, and there's a variety of pieces in there that help our program out. The first notable one is that compliance with AIS inspections is an express condition of operating or transporting water-related equipment, and that's pulled straight from statutory language. So if you are transporting a boat anywhere throughout Minnesota or operating that boat, you are giving your consent to an inspection. There's always conflict at the accesses, and people talk about illegal searches or try to equate it to maybe DUI checkpoints or things of that nature. That piece of the statute, I think, really helps with that. Inspectors, that authority that we talked about, they may prohibit the placing of watercraft or water-related equipment, is what we call it, into waters of the state. So if an inspector does find something, or if that boater refuses an inspection, we do have the state authority to actually stop them from putting it in. That authority is verbal. You know, we don't train our staff to get into confrontations. They just try to use their language and conflict resolution to relay what would happen. We would call conservation officers for follow-up if they decided to launch anyways or didn't remove anything. As far as what we inspect, that's in statute as well, and it says that we can visually and tactilely inspect the water-related equipment. So inspectors are looking, they can touch. Again, we have protocols to try to be really cautious and customer service related there. If you've seen inspections out west or in Colorado or some of these other places, you'll see inspectors get inside boats. They might help open up compartments or walk around inside the boat quite often. Our staff, we stay outside of the boat unless we have their express permission at the time to go in. But really, we're always asking the boaters to do all the opening of compartments and things of that nature. The other unique piece that Minnesota has is that law enforcement can set up roadside check stations to inspect equipment being transported along Minnesota roads. So inspectors are stationed at accesses, but law enforcement can set up a check station where everybody driving down the road, if you're hauling a boat or any other kind of water-related equipment, you're required to pull in. We have inspectors there that'll do a quick inspection. But law enforcement's there to write citations or warnings or talk to the boaters that are there. With that piece, the conservation officers have a guidance document, and if people are interested in this side of things, they can certainly connect John or anybody else to the appropriate channels within enforcement. But they work with the county attorneys always to set up these stations. They have very strict safety protocols to try and be as safe as possible with these. So there's a lot of paperwork and requirements that they've set up for it. Next slide. And I'll just close my 15 minutes here with some challenges that we do have. I didn't talk a whole lot about decontamination. Decontamination in Minnesota remains to be a challenge. We have 23 units within the Minnesota DNR, and then there are numerous units that are out there from counties as well However, the numbers of decontaminations remains relatively low, and that's largely due to, potentially due to this, the way our statutes are worded. We don't have a very strong statutory language regarding decontamination. There's, like, I'll give you an example of out west in Colorado, the decontamination is in statute that it's decontamination is being done by a trained person with hot water. Our statute, decontamination talks about the removal or treatment of things. Water is included, but it's not only water, and no type of person is identified. So decontamination could be done by the boater by removing vegetation from the trailer. According to our statutory language, that's a decontamination. Decontamination with the equipment remains largely voluntary. We're really only requiring it by law if we have a unit present on site and we find something like zebra mussels that are attached, and then we can legally require it. But for a lot of these decontaminations where we're trying to do what I would consider legally here voluntary decontaminations is a watercraft to tie into my master's research, a wakeboard boat with ballast tanks is leaving this one lake today and they're going to another lake tomorrow. We'd like to decontaminate that. Really, it's up to the inspectors to be good, almost salesmen, to try and encourage that decontamination and for the boat owner to take the time to do it. Other challenges that we have, the annual training and staffing is always going to be a challenge with our program just because of the sheer size that we have. You can certainly talk to any of our counties. You know, a common complaint that we get is that training is annual, first and foremost, and that they have to attend in-person training, so they might have to drive to places, and there's a lot of logistical challenges there. 2020, we had different challenges with COVID. We did move to a purely online format. 2021, I am foreseeing a very similar approach, maybe a little bit more hybrid, but definitely online for the main piece. And then staffing is a challenge. Again, with 60 plus different inspection programs out there, finding bodies that want to do this work does get difficult, and it can get even more difficult depending on the area. So I live in Minneapolis. We have a pretty easy time finding people to do this here. Some counties, more rural, more remote, just don't have the workforce that's interested in doing something like this. And so they'll struggle to hire their two or three people that they'd like to for the season. Other challenges, again, ensuring statutory language is clear and enforceable. The decontamination piece is really the main piece there as far as what we struggle with still today. Other things that we've tried to fix throughout this process are things like calling what the terminology is inside of state statute. As an example for that, when the inspection authority first happened, we had the legal authority to inspect watercraft, and that was what was listed in statute. And we quickly realized that watercraft isn't a great example for what we're inspecting. Is a trailer included in that? You know, what's the overall definition of watercraft? And that was changed to the term that I've referred to a couple of times now as water-related equipment. Water-related equipment is defined in statute as pretty much a boat, trailer, tool, implement, or device capable of transporting water or invasive species. And so it's this catch-all term that expanded what we were able to inspect, even though that was really the goal from the start. So, you know, if you're looking at doing things through the legislature and getting new statutes created, try to make sure that whatever terms you're using are defined and as clear as possible for what you're looking to do. So decontamination and the inspection aspect are two clear pieces to that. Dry time is another one that's very difficult. We don't have a statutory requirement for dry time. There are some states that do. I personally struggle with dry time as a requirement, especially looking back on my knowledge with boats and my master's research. One of the areas I looked at was engine compartments the cooling systems for watercraft, mostly on inboard and stern drive, inboard outboard engines. And we were draining the engine blocks to look for veligers through this process. It's been a while now, but I think the most water I pulled out of a Volvo stern drive engine was 11 liters of water. And that's water that's present inside that boat pretty much forever, right? So even though the outside is bone dry, I just struggle personally with identifying legally what dry means, because I think boats have water in them. Most of them are always going to have some bit of water, regardless of how long it's been out of the water. It's just trying to quantify the risk that that water poses. Lastly, a question I always get is proving, and maybe somebody's got it here, but prove what evidence do you have that watercraft inspection works? And in Minnesota, you know, we do continuously see new infestations occurring across the state. Some, as I mentioned, from connected waterways, some are new. That does boil down, at least in part, to the fact that there are multiple vectors for invasive species to spread throughout Minnesota. And I would assume that South Dakota is relatively similar in that, with private property on lakes, so lakeshore owners with things like boat lifts. Boat lifts are an incredibly high risk of infesting a new water body with something like zebra mussels if they're being sold or removed from a zebra mussel infested lake and being installed in a uninfested lake. You're potentially moving thousands of mussels alive in close proximity to each other from one lake to another. There's always private resorts and marinas. Our inspection program, again, is largely at public water accesses. That's what all our authority is written for. So it's always up to the marina owners or the resort owners to try and take some initiative to get inspections there. We do have programs that are working on that, but it's always a challenge of time and money and staff to do those things. The other one that is getting more attention is just organisms in trade. And we did hire a new staff person in recent years to be our organisms in trade specialist. And that's looking at ways to interrupt or at least educate the different places that are buying and selling organisms in trade, fish stores, aquarium stores, aquatic plant vendors, things of that nature. It's largely unregulated. There's nobody checking. There's not necessarily the education level that's there. So that's another one as well. It's a lot of information to throw at everybody here, but thank you for listening, and I am happy to answer any questions that anybody has.
Thank you, Adam, very much. That was instructional and helpful. And are there questions, comments? Adam, what do you think, what have you found, what do you think has been most persuasive in Minnesota? What gets people engaged, whether it's the public or government, or, I mean, what are the best 2-3 points you say to people, here's why we need this program, here's the problem, here's what we're trying to prevent? What do you think is, you know, on the top, whatever, 2-3 list of things that are most persuasive?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, number one is that there is a demonstrated risk from watercraft and the movement of watercraft from point A to point B. There are countless studies, there's countless research that's been done on that topic. We certainly have evidence every single season about species being intercepted during watercraft inspections. So that's number one. The watercraft inspection program is one way to get at that, right? So we're trying to provide education first and foremost to boaters that are out at the access. And that works for a while. Minnesota, you know, has a pretty educated public when it comes to invasive species. Once you're educated and you know about milfoil and you know about zebra mussels, I think where inspectors really excel at is becoming a second set of eyes. And I think of transport of invasive species can happen by anybody. It's an accidental, there's accidental introductions that occur. So if we think about violations in other areas like seatbelt laws, that's a binary option. You're either wearing your seatbelt today or you're not. You didn't put it on three quarters of the way, and but you know, through an accident, you didn't click it or whatever. Watercraft inspection, you can be very knowledgeable about your boat and very careful, but it was dark yesterday and it was raining, or I had to get somewhere real quick and I missed some fragment of milfoil and there's 100 zebra mussels on it. So even though I'm a very educated person and it's me doing it, an inspector serves as a second set of eyes to help with that process. Also, there's always the new boater contingent. People come in and, you know, we'll see people show up with drain plugs in, and it's because it's their first boat of the season. You know, it's on everybody's personal responsibility to read the watercraft regulations and the fishing regulations. And, you know, in a perfect world that happens, but we know it doesn't always. And that education piece is always there. I do think that the lake associations that we have here, there are some very organized lake associations that are very vocal about inspections and the efficacy of inspection programs. That's a good piece for the legislature to hear and to have advocates for inspection programs is another, you know, a good way to get information out and using lake associations to help share that information throughout the members of the lake association as well, especially when it comes to things like boat lifts and getting that education to make sure that all the people on the lake are following the rules too, or to try to take down the us versus them mentality that sometimes occurs here with lake shore owners and transient boaters.
How about the issue of why should we care? Why are we trying to limit these zebra mussels? What's the problem? What if the goal is to limit the spread? Why are we doing that? What's most persuasive there when you talk to people to say, here's why we should all care about this?
Sure. You know, that's one that hopefully from an inspector perspective, we try to give them a variety of different tools to answer that to be most useful to the boat owner that they're talking to. When I would talk to people about that in general terms, you know, anytime a new species enters a lake, it's a new stress on an environment that's going to stress that environment in an unknown way. So zebra mussels in Lake Minnetonka will affect that ecosystem differently than zebra mussels in the St. Croix River, which for whatever reason has a relatively low number of mussels. So there's that biological piece. You know, zebra mussels are filter feeders. They're eating algae. They're not eating cyanobacteria, so they're not eating any of the blue greens. So there potentially can be a effect there of concentrating blue greens in the water, and we know that's toxic to humans and dogs and other organisms. There is research coming out of the University of Minnesota right now that's looking at quantifying zebra mussels' effect on young walleye growth, and they're looking at spiny water flea and zebra mussels, but what effect do they have on walleye? So walleye obviously aren't disappearing entirely from lakes with zebra mussels being introduced, but the young of the year growing at a slower rate, and so recruitment is slowing down, and that's potentially a cause of zebra mussels. So that's, you know, something to talk to with fishermen. From pure boat owners' perspectives, zebra mussels can grow inside of engines. You know, especially if your boat's moored, they're typically going to be in the lower unit area where the water intake is, as opposed to inside the actual engine. They'll also encrust the outside. You'll have to clean everything. The performance of the boat will go down. You can see pictures of boats that come out of the lake and they're totally encrusted from top to bottom, any piece that touches the water with mussels. And then likewise, just from a recreation perspective, they're very sharp. They can cut your feet. they certainly have cut people's feet. A lot of people will wear water shoes or sandals in the water. So even if you're just going to a lake that has a public beach, how you're interacting with that water body is going to change if you have zebra mussels present.
Mr. Chairman?
Whoops, sorry, I was on mute. Go ahead, Commissioner Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think to follow up on what you've been asking, Mr. Chairman, is what does success look like? Because, I mean, you guys are throwing a lot of money at this and a tremendous human effort. You slow down the spread, and yet many people say that you can't stop it, you can only slow it down, so it's eventually just going to get worse. So why put all this money and personnel behind it when the end is already foretold? So again, what does success look like at the end of this? Because we can't stop them, correct?
Yeah, so maybe it's a little bit of a trite answer, but there's the saying that in ounce of prevention, now I'm going to screw up the saying, what it's an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure or treatment. Yeah. So the prevention is expensive, and we do spend a good amount of money on especially the human component of watercraft inspection, but it is much, much cheaper than the alternative of trying to treat all of the water bodies for these species. And some don't have good alternatives or good management solutions. You know, you can always use herbicides for curly leaf pondweed or milfoil. You can't use molluscicides, or you can, but it's going to kill a lot of other things, for something like a zebra mussel. And treatments that are available can be very expensive or ecologically expensive. So you're killing other organisms. You know, we do have a lot of endangered mussels in Minnesota, and so if there are endangered populations of mussels in lakes, introducing a molluscicide is going to kill them as well. Like you said, we can't stop it, it's inevitable. I don't know that I wholeheartedly agree with the fact that it's inevitable. I do think it's an uphill battle every single step of the way and every day with inspectors that are out there. That's where having good support staff and trying to do your best to train and equip inspectors to do the job well is very important. Sometimes I'll hear from people, you know, it's just watercraft inspection, it's not rocket science. But in reality, try to transport yourself to be an inspector at a lake on a hot 98 degree day. You've got a line of boaters that already have been inspected a half a dozen times before. You're by yourself, you're alone, you're doing a repetitive task. You might be getting grief from boaters. I think it's really a challenging thing, and I always talk to our younger inspectors to not undersell the skills they're learning in an internship. On one hand, they're inspecting boats, but they're working in a regulatory capacity, and conflict resolution and things that will benefit them throughout their professional career. So having a good staff, helps, I think, with that, or getting a better and better bang for your dollar on the inspection program. I've gone on a little bit of a tangent here, but I would hope that in good inspection programs that are operating smoothly are helping try to buffer the inevitable, I guess. So if these species are going to move around and continue to do so, research is still ongoing, and there are a variety of different research projects. Hopefully the inspection programs can serve as a way to stop or slow the spread until research can find solutions that are ecologically and financially feasible.
Okay, thank you. Great presentation.
Yeah.
Yep, excellent presentation. Any other questions, comments? Thank you again, Adam, very, very much.